From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 28 for Friday, the 3rd of June, 2011. On the show this week... Happy birthday, Sonic the Hedgehog. Hip, hip, hooray, all that stuff. It's 20 years this month since the first Sonic the Hedgehog game was released on the Sega Mega Drive, so we took a trip to Sega headquarters to chat with the company's CEO about the past, present, and most importantly, the future for Sonic the nearly middle-aged hedgehog. That's coming up after we spin-dash through the Mobius strip of this week's Wired News. Hey there. I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in Green Hill Zone this week is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
I always preferred the midnight one. What was it called?
Casino
Night Zone.
That was, I think,
had the best music.
Yeah, that was Sonic 2.
Yeah, I think. That's where you'd find me lurking, not the horrible underwater temple where I kept drowning.
Those were horrible. I hated those levels. You may notice the absence of Olivia_Solon's voice, and that is because she is in Australia for the Vivid Sydney Festival, so she's probably asleep right now. Hey, Liv.
Or just bouncing around like a kangaroo.
That's true. Actually, she should have taken the Kigu. She has that kangaroo Kigu with the Joey patch.
That's true, yeah.
Which we'll all remember from the Christmas episode. Anyway, we're going to talk about Sonic a little bit later on. First, I want us to talk about a guy who has to say sorry a lot.
This is a Malaysian blogger, a chap called Fami Fadzil, who tweeted back in January that a pregnant friend of his had been badly treated by her employers. And those employers didn't like this very much. And he apologized for the allegation a couple of hours later, but they demanded damages for defamation and financial compensation and all those kinds of things. But he's managed to settle the case by promising to tweet an apology 100 times over 3 days.
And what does the tweet read?
He says, "I've defamed Blue Ink Media and Female Magazine. My tweets on their HR policies are untrue. I retract those words and hereby apologize." And he's tweeting that maybe like every half hour or something at the moment from his account.
Yeah, he's got about, I think, 4,500 followers now. He seems to have gained quite a few since the start of all this. And what's quite funny is that he sort of, a couple of his tweets are like, "I have to, you know, one more to go in a couple of minutes and then I'm having dinner."
I guess it's almost a bit like community service, but on Twitter.
It is. I mean, this underscores a kind of sailing in uncharted waters to a certain extent, because this is another example of what is the law on Twitter. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the conversations about whether libel was libel in a chat room or whether it was slander. It is actually slander, and the charges for slander are slightly less serious than they are for libel. And it's just kind of, this is this conversation coming up once again.
Yeah, and it's been in the news actually a lot recently, what with the super injunction fiasco and also South Tyneside Council going over to California to try and unmask one of its anonymous critics.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's, I mean, at least it's good to see that this guy's not going to get shafted for prison sentences and stuff and just has to say sorry a lot. I mean, that's what we had to do in school. I remember when I put gum in people's hair, I had to write, "I am sorry for
you
putting..."
You put gum in people's hair?
That was
That's
sort
a
of
a horrible thing to do.
That was one of my least impressive crimes. I did some really fantastic stuff when I was a kid.
Are you going to share any of them right now?
No, absolutely not, because I don't want to say sorry for those. Instead, I want to talk about Call of Duty, and Activision has decided that it's going to release something called Call of Duty Elite. And what this is a plan to give players of games like Black Ops and Modern Warfare 3 bonus contents like access to clans and mobile apps and competition leagues and things where you can win stuff in real life through an upcoming subscription package. Basically, it's them saying you pay for Xbox Live, now pay us for some extra online services that we can't previously charge for.
But isn't clans and leagues and things people were just doing anyway?
Yeah. These things have been around for a long time for free. I mean, they reckon that it's a premium service and they're giving you stuff that you can't otherwise get. But it's another one of these examples that a lot of major publishers in the gaming world are doing now, which is they're trying to incentivize people who want to play online games more by trying to charge them for something they've already technically paid for, i.e. Xbox Live or PlayStation Plus.
Yeah, and especially with downloadable content. I mean, is this basically just downloadable content for multiplayer? I mean, how is it?
It's a little different to that. I mean, the classic example that I've been seeing a lot recently, most recently, was for Dirt 3, which is where you buy a game new and you get a code in the box that you redeem and you get access to the online stuff. But if you buy that game pre-owned or if you lose the card or whatever, then you have to pay something like £5 or £10 to play those games online. So if you bought it for, say, £35 pre-owned from Game, the game really wants you to do, then you would take that game home and you wouldn't be able to play any of the online services or online elements of that game, even though you've paid for Xbox Live every month or every year, until you pay whoever the publisher is to play that game online.
But isn't that fair enough? Just playing devil's advocate for a second.
No.
Because you know, the publishers have to keep the servers running. They've got to keep moderators checking over the servers to make sure people aren't spamming homophobic and racist slurs.
No, I disagree. I don't think it's any different from the person who first bought that game continuing to play it. At all. I think they've charged £40-45 for a game. It's got an online counterpart. It's no different. The person who sold that game is no longer playing it. Someone new is now playing it. So it's just extending the life of the game that they've already sold. I mean, they can basically keep charging for that over and over and over again. I could sell it, and then they could sell it, and they could sell it, and they can sell it. And, you know, a company like Activision or Electronic Arts or whoever, Codemasters, can just keep charging.
For the record, I completely agree with you. I'm just, you know, this makes for a more interesting podcast.
You're just being
podcast.
An ass. Yeah, no, I agree. I'm going to have a massive rant on the website about why I don't think people should be paying to play online when they've already paid Microsoft to play online. But for the record, a lot of Call of Duty's fans are pretty annoyed by the move as well. There's been a group called, I can't remember their name now.
The Gun Shop?
That's it, The Gun Shop. And they have put videos up and set up a blog and things. They call the service a douche move on Activision's part. Quote, "It is out of pure greed and lack of respect for their community that Activision has decided to charge a subscription fee for the content to be provided under Call of Duty Elite, services that other developers offer for free. Make it free or GTFO." You can Google what that means if you want. I don't want an explicit tag on our podcast. We put up with raised game prices. This comes from a 36-year-old gamer called Jesse Van Leuven, who says, "It's insulting. We put up with raised game prices, pay subscription fees on Xbox Live, and have to pay more than we should for downloadable content. And yet here is Activision adding a new fee just because they think they can get more money out of gamers, not to bring something new to us." Would you agree?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, as I say, you can kind of argue both sides of the coin here. It is a bit ridiculous. I do think it's something that we'll probably see increasing over time, especially from companies like Activision, who also they're kind of merged with Blizzard, and Blizzard makes an enormous amount of money from World of Warcraft players paying a monthly fee every month. Activision has surely just seen that and thought, oh yeah, we want to get a bit of that.
I think the big difference between that and this is that it is only an online game. You are only ever playing online. You have millions of people constantly playing online all at one time, whereas something like Call of Duty or, in my example, Dirt 3 or something like that, which is a great game, it's temporary. You know, you're only occasionally maybe playing online. But to be fair, we should point out Activision's social media rep, Dan Amrick, posted a short FAQ about the Elite service and said, "You may not see the value until you get to try it yourself, but that's where this summer's beta comes in handy." So they reckon it's worth it.
So how do you sign up for that beta? Have they published the details?
I'm not sure if they have yet.
Okay.
It's coming later this year.
When they do, we'll be reporting on it. So stay tuned to wired.co.uk.
We will. That's enough stuff about games. Duncan, tell me about nukes. No, don't. Tell me about nuclear power in
Germany. It has nothing to do with nukes. It's Germany's coalition vowing to shut down all of the country's nuclear reactors by 2022, following, of course, the Fukushima disaster in Japan.
Now, this is a bit of a U-turn for their government. They have a coalition too, I think, don't they?
They have a coalition, yeah. A lot of European countries have coalitions much more frequently than we tend to. But their coalition has long been quite in favour of nuclear power, saying that it's a good bridge between you know, massively polluting coal and oil plants and going to renewables, with renewables obviously the goal in the end. But since the Fukushima disaster, they've done a complete U-turn and agreed with the opposing coalition, the Social Democrats and the Greens, who've long been very, very anti-nuclear energy.
So what does this mean for Germany's power grid? Are they just going to switch off these reactors and everyone's going to have to use less, you know, online gaming services for a bit?
Well, no, what they're hoping to do is cut power use in Germany just totally by 10% by 2020, you know, through efficiency measures, you know, insulation and so on and so forth. And also dramatically expand the use of renewables in the country. At the moment, it's about 17% of the country's energy budget, and they want to double that to about 35%. For comparison, nuclear power currently is about 23% of Germany's energy budget.
And so really the idea here is, over time, drop the amount of power that's being consumed, but also raise the amount of power that's being produced from renewable sources like solar power.
Yeah, exactly that. But what's interesting is it's the most drastic move by far from an industrialized country in the wake of Fukushima. There's been, you know, other countries have said, yes, we'll definitely review our nuclear power plant safety, you know, situations. But Germany have suddenly said, no, we're not having nuclear at all.
In that accent?
Yeah, well, no, in a German accent, I presume.
How would they do that?
I'm not going to do that.
It's a shame. Liv would.
But yeah, Germany has long, for a few years, had a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2020.
And we need to, because I think, didn't we have a record last year for the...
Yeah, greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide emissions hit a record high last year, and to keep... But there was an agreement at the most recent climate talks from the industrialized nations that they'd keep the temperature change of the world below 2 degrees. And to do that now, we're going to have to have a smaller rise in emissions in the next 10 years than we had over the last year.
Blimey.
So don't think that's going to happen.
So it's not going to happen,
no,
is it?
No, we're pretty much stuck with over 2 degrees now.
Sorry, world.
Sorry, world.
We're stuffed. Well, we're going to take a very quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about what's going to happen on your iPhone next week.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
So next week marks two interesting events. One is E3, which we'll be covering probably quite a lot, I imagine, but the other... is that Steve Jobs, Apple CEO, is going to be on stage in San Francisco to...
Like you need to introduce him.
Fair enough. Everyone knows he's on the front cover of Wired this month. We know. No, he is going to be getting on stage to introduce what we know is going to be called iCloud. This has been rumored for a long time to be Apple's subscription music service that could rival Spotify. But actually what it looks like is being something far more wide-reaching and not just being about a subscription-based music streaming service from iTunes, but also a bunch of other stuff. Apple filed a trademark, and under the trademark for iCloud, it wants to cover things such as digital music by digital music by telecommunications, think phone and internet, electronic storage, online social networking services, multimedia content for a fee or prepaid subscription, computer software, electronics, books and magazines, entertainment, photographic services, business management and advertising services, games, headgear, and digital devices and computers.
So basically everything Apple has ever done and ever will do, and headgear.
Everything that has been filed under the iCloud trademark covers App Store, selling apps, digital music, digital books like iBooks, magazine subscriptions, iPhone, Mac, you name it, Game Center, and backup services and everything.
And headgear.
I don't know what the headgear is.
No, that's a really interesting one.
I'm not sure what that one's going to be.
Maybe an iHat next year.
Wireless headgear, headsets, I don't know.
Could be.
But what it does suggest is that iCloud is about to be something that comprises everything from Apple's App Store services and things like the Mac App Store and the iPhone App Store, as well as new services like music streaming, as well as things like selling books, you know, so the iBook Store, things like that. It looks like, and MobileMe, of course, everything is going to go under that iCloud
banner.
Mm. And it's pretty exciting. I mean, so much of this has been rumored for a long time, and they have a data center in California, I think, that is massive and currently unused. It's ginormous. For a while, actually, they had Google block it from its, not its Street View, Google Maps and things like that, so you couldn't actually see it properly when you looked at like aerial view. And they've recently said to Google they can unblock it, so you can now go and have a look at this thing and see this little road sort of snaking up to this now unblurred data center. So some pretty big stuff coming next week. Watch out for it if you have an iPhone. They'll also be showing off iOS 5, which is the next iteration of the iPhone operating system for iPads and things, and also the next version of OS X Lion. And the idea, everyone thinks, is that iCloud is going to be pulling bundling all of those devices together with all of those services we mentioned. So,
I mean, speaking personally, it's the music streaming stuff that's most interesting to me. And what's particularly interesting now is that everybody's just talking about it as if it exists.
Yeah, it's kind of weird for Apple to do something like this, actually. They sent an email out, tiny little press release, just to say we're going to be having Steve Jobs on stage next week at WWDC, and he's going to talk about iCloud and iOS 5. And that was the first time Apple ever actually confirmed iCloud. And it's been rumored for ages. We knew that they were doing something like this because we've seen things like they bought the website iCloud.com and all that kind of stuff. But Apple normally never would say, oh, we're going to show off iPhone, you know, before announcing the iPhone. It's very uncharacteristic. So,
and normally those leaks come from people like bosses at record labels and things like that. And, and it sounds like they've got all the four major record labels signed on to this music thing. But,
apparently.
But notably, they haven't got the publishers, and they need the publishers before they can do any kind of deal whatsoever. And they also haven't got Merlin on, who represent all of the, well, most of the indie labels, most of the big indie labels. So it'll be weird to see. I'm sure they will do a deal and buy a announcing it probably gives them more of a strong arm in those negotiations, but to get that sorted before launch.
As a bit of background for anyone who doesn't know how Apple tends to do this, is that whenever they launch a service on iTunes, so say the iTunes Plus, where they went DRM free, it always starts with, you know, some of the majors or all of the majors, and then over time all the indie labels and other licenses jump on board, and eventually you can get whatever they're offering from everyone. But to begin with, it's often from a limited number of people. Looks like this would be, you'll be able to stream from all the majors, but not everything will be available for streaming.
Well, even with that, they'll need to get the publishers on board, but that, yeah. I imagine that's a doable task.
We will know on the 6th of June. Duncan, have you ever wanted to be smacked in the head with a giant robotic arm with tasers on the end?
I can't say I have.
Because your chances have just increased if you want to go out and do a crime.
You're talking about The Bodyguard, right?
Not the movie, The Giant Arm, yes.
The Giant Arm. This is a story we put up on the site this week about a new, I guess it's a weapon. Is it a weapon? Is it a self-defense tool?
I think it's a crime prevention utility.
Yeah, I mean, they're selling it. Well, what this is a... It's a glove made of ballistic nylon that has basically a taser built in and a video camera and a laser pointer. It just sounds like the best thing ever.
It kind of reminds me, I don't know if anyone is as nerdy about Red Dwarf as I am, but there was an episode called The Inquisitor.
All must answer to the Inquisitor.
Where he had this giant gauntlet with a lot of buttons on it that could sort of zap people and kill you and erase entire existences from history. Kind of looks like that.
and it's called The Bodyguard, which is brilliant because Kevin Costner is one of the investors, which is just awesome. They've said, well, like everybody says with every weapon, that it's designed to deter violence rather than dole it out.
Yeah, it's designed to give you a giant smack around the head if you're breaking windows.
Yeah, and so the creators are hoping is that when you point this camera at people, and you wave the... It's got a green laser pointer on the end that you can shine on their forehead. And if you've got that pointing on you, you're probably not going to do some crimes.
Yeah. It's kind of a shame that I'm not sticking gum in people's hair. Otherwise, I might be able to get hands-on with this. Admittedly, from the wrong side of the law, but it might be worth it.
The scariest bit is there's two electrodes on the top of the glove, and you can press a little button in the palm to make a spark jump between the two of them.
Just it really is just to scare the hell out of crimers.
Pretty much. And if it doesn't work, then you can smack them with it and tase them.
I'd love to see this on Jeremy Kyle. Could you imagine what he would do if he had a glove that could shine lasers and things?
The best thing is the backstory. They came up with the idea after they got attacked by a mountain lion in California in 2004, and they wanted a protective weapon that you can't drop or you can't have taken off you. It's basically stuck on you. And 7 years, 30 prototypes later, here it is.
And it's going to be out, I think, later this year for someone?
Yeah, well, the LA Sheriff's Department are going to be the first people to get it. They're getting the first demo unit, and then hopefully it will roll out a little bit further next year. Well, I say hopefully. I'm a bit scared of it. Maybe I'm not hopeful at all.
Do you like crime? Do you like gloves? If so, let us know. Go and do a crime. I mean, don't. We're not in, you know, we're not suggesting you. Yeah, you know what I mean. If you get hit with this, then let us know what it is.
It's not going to be a good thing.
No. Don't do crime, kids. Crime's really bad. Crime is bad. It's like drugs. Don't, just stay away.
Moving swiftly on.
Please. A guy in Amsterdam has built an ark. And he wants to sail it into the Thames and dock it there for the Olympics next year so that kids between Olympic events can come and play with animals on it.
What?
Yeah. It's an ark, apparently the size of the one, allegedly in the Bible, that has a load of animals on it. And this guy, who is, I think, Dutch, Johan Hubers, I want to believe is how you pronounce his name.
Yeah, that's probably not far off.
I apologize. It's probably totally wrong. Has built this ark, and it's about 450 feet long and 75 feet wide. And he wants to fill it with animals and animatronic robots and things like that. And he wants to sail it from Amsterdam into the Thames and dock it there for people to play with animals when there isn't, you know, a sprint going on or an egg and spoon race.
So can you actually get an ark through the Thames barrier? Is it small enough? I don't know how big an ark is.
I just told you how big it is, but we're not sure if it'll get down there. I think it should. I've seen some pretty big ferries go down that place when we're having a nice tea and crumpet on the banks. But it's
I suppose they got that statue of Michael Jackson through it, so
it's basically going to be down to the approval of old Boris Johnson. He seems like the kind of guy that would like an ark sailing down the capital.
Yeah, I think he probably would approve this one.
You know, you've got a Boris bike, have a Boris ark. Anyway, we'll find out whether that happens next year when we get our Olympic on. For now, though, we're going to move briefly onto our feature this week, which involves hedgehogs.
Hello? Rebel Radio Request Line? Let me hear that way cool Sonic song again.
Duncan, did you ever play Sonic much as a kid?
I did play it a little bit, but not loads and loads. I was more of a sort of Mario person or theme parks, SimCity, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was addicted to Sonic when I was little. Still am, actually. Still have it on my iPhone. And it's his 20th birthday this year. I mean, it's
birthday, Sonic.
It's probably more like his 36, because I think he was a teenager in the first game.
Yeah.
And the first game came out in 1991 in June on the Mega Drive.
Ah.
And kind of amazing, really. But yeah, he's 20 years old, and over the last 10 years or so, there have been quite a few 3D Sonic games that, quite frankly, have been crap. They've not necessarily been appealing to the same demographic that the original games appealed to, but nonetheless, they seem to be trying to turn things around with things like Sonic 4 now.
We had a big argument in the office the other week about Sonic and whether he was, like, if you stroked him, whether he'd be spiny or whether he'd be fluffy.
I think all that spin dashing means he'd be pretty soft.
Well, yeah, I would have thought so as well. But Olivia_Solon was like, no, definitely. Spines all over him. He would not be a pleasant thing to stroke. I don't think so.
Sadly, that wasn't on my list of questions to talk to Sega's CEO about.
I'm very disappointed in you.
Earlier this week. No, I know. It's a big shame. But I did. I went over and met with Mike Hayes, who is the CEO of Sega Europe and Sega West. And I went over to have a chat with him about the past, present, and future of Sonic and find out exactly where this little guy is going next.
I'm here with Mike Hayes, CEO of Sega Europe and Sega America, and David Corless, the Sonic brand director. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. David, first, this month marks the 20th anniversary of Sonic the Hedgehog after the first game came out on the Sega Mega Drive in 1991. In many ways, he's had quite a turbulent ride over the last few years in some respects. How healthy is Sonic looking these days?
Sonic's very healthy at the moment. He's had some fantastic successes over the last few years. You know, I think it's fair to say, though, it's, you know, he hasn't had a fallow year. If you look at a lot of the individual titles back in the day as well, I think there's been some great successes. And but I think just there's been a real resurgence of excitement in the Sonic brand again, and he's back in a good place.
I think that's been one of the interesting things of Sega getting out of hardware, you know, several years ago, is that we've been able to bring Sonic to different platforms, and I think that's enabled us to do different things with the character. The fact that we're sort of platform agnostic now, I think, has given Sonic a whole new lease of life, and that's really given the Sonic team and the marketers a chance to do something different with our mascot, which I think on the whole has been very successful.
Definitely, and I want to talk a little bit about the iPhone a little later on. In terms of Sonic, what's next for the Sonic franchise?
The very next step is Sonic Generations, which is a fantastic looking game for PS3 and 360. And it's, I suppose, the ultimate celebration of 20 years of Sonic, in which you'll get to play as classic Sonic again for the first time in about 16, 17 years. And you get to play as modern Sonic as well, and bringing those two established characters together. So in terms of ultimate immediate next steps, that is the next one. In terms of the long-term goal, you know, we are looking at continuing this trend of creating fantastic Sonic games, utilizing all the different platforms that Mike's just spoken about, And really sort of developing Sonic strong quality games for different types of audience against different types of platforms. And I think that's where you need to go with you know, a character as big as Sonic and as popular as Sonic.
What about the Nintendo 3DS? What plans are there? I've heard a few rumblings and the grapevine.
Well,
Mike.
Well, I mean, you know, we're a big supporter of the Nintendo platforms, and we were one of the first to be out with Super Monkey Ball on 3DS. And I think it's pretty safe to say that Sonic's going to make some pretty impressive appearances on that platform.
Do you have any kind of time frame? Maybe this year?
Maybe.
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 That's as close as I'm going to get, I imagine. Okay, so Sonic 4 Episode 1 effectively saw the franchise rebooted as a classic 2D platformer nearly two decades after it was first released. What's next in store for the Sonic 4 series?
There are plans. I think we've been pretty open when Episode 1 came out that it is an episodic game. So you'll probably see further installments of that. And we did really well with Episode 1. I think Sega in itself is very, very happy with Sonic. We had some fantastic feedback, some great scores, and I think people were just excited to see Sonic going back to his roots.
Yeah, I was one of them.
Very good. Yeah. And yeah, it was an exciting time, I think, for everyone like yourselves, you know, journalists who've grown up with Sonic, fans who've grown up with Sonic, and us at Sega, you know, when we first saw Sonic 4 Episode 1, it was sort of really reminded us what Sonic was all about and why we got excited in the first place. And I do think that sort of classic platforming 2D action still has a place in today's 3D, you know, uber technology, and sales have only proven that I think we're right in the decision we made there.
Yeah, I think Dave's right. And to add to what he said as well, I think where you talked about where is he headed in the future, and I think one of the things that we're anxious to do with the character is to see how he can expand onto all the different platforms. So like you say, we've seen him on XBLA and PSN and iPhone and so forth, and I think that there are opportunities for Sonic to appear in ways that suit platforming. So you know, you've got to look at the growth of premium gaming, look at the different devices, you know, you've got the tablets that are growing, you know, there's no definite plans, but the point about where we want to go is to get Sonic into these different areas, because we want to follow the consumer and where the consumer's going, that where the Sonic fans are. So that's an interesting thing for us as we work through the roadmap for the next sort of 3 to 5 years, is how do we bring Sonic into different areas and sort of expand the reach of the character. And to that end, he may be doing different things on the different platforms, and that's again interesting for the development teams to think about how they can make Sonic more relevant for those interesting new platforms.
Definitely. It seems like whenever a new console, in fact, or gaming platform makes it big, Sega releases titles like Sonic and other classics, Golden Axe, Streets of Rage, things like that, on these platforms, most recently iPhone and Xbox, as we talked about. Do you think this will always be the case, or is there a limit to how many times people will want to rebuy their favourite old games from the 90s?
It's a good question. I think ultimately there's going to be a limit of how many times people want to enjoy that nostalgia. Although, if I'm perfectly honest, we're still amazed at the fan base that Sega still has. And how many of our original games sell and do so well, and for that we're grateful and very thankful. I think going forward, as ever, what we want to do is try and take those strong IP and reimagine them. And that is, it seems easy, but actually it's quite difficult, because to reimagine something that people love so much, you have to be very careful about how you sort of you break it open and go in a different direction to make it relevant for a new audience. So we're constantly looking at our IP, and I think particularly with digital avenues, we can afford to be more ambitious, I think, with the way we take that existing IP. And over the next 2 years, you'll see some of our famous IP be reborn as digital offerings. And how we get that balance right between the old and the new is quite key. So I think the actual shelf life of the back catalogue, as it were, will of course be limited, but we intend to take the IP into the future and redesign and re-emerge it.
How do new tablets such as the iPad fit into Sega's strategy going forward?
Well, the tablets, we think, will ultimately offer us an incredibly large platform. And the point about the tablet is that it can appeal on a wide variety of demographic. So it could be that it will appeal to the family and a kind of Sonic game that may appear. On the other hand, with our Total War and Football Manager range, and Football Manager's already on iPad, there are ways that we think we can expand our PC consumer over to the tablet. So if I'm honest, there's still a lot of work we need to do, how we can use the technology, how it could be relevant in the home to use. But there's no doubt that the tablet is going to be a major platform for us in the next 2 to 5 years. And I think that's a very exciting thing. And again, it's good for developers because they have to start thinking about gaming in a slightly different way.
With that in mind, do you ever think that Sega may at some point get back into the hardware business?
No, not at all. We're a software company. You know, there are the hardware companies that exist spend billions and billions of dollars to get into that business. And Sega's very clearly set its stall out as a software company. What we want to do is enjoy taking our IP and creating new IP on as many of those platforms as possible.
That was a no.
Yes.
That's right.
I guess finally, is what I'd like to ask is, what has been the most important lesson learned about Sonic over the last 10 years? And where do you see that, how do you see that affecting where he'll be in the next 10 years?
I think platform innovation dictates sometimes where we're going to go and what we're going to do. You know, obviously the Wii came out and it allowed us to do different things with Sonic that we'd never done before. The emergence of the digital market and, you know, iOS platforms and Android platforms allowed us in a way to revisit classic Sonic and allow us to take that to a broader audience. So I think in a way technology will always dictate, and that is, I think, part of the games industry. That's for every brand.
I think one of the things as well, since Sega became a software-only company, Sonic has developed this, very broad terms, two target audiences. We have our fan base, like us three, that have grown up with it, and Sonic Generations speaks to that, and the Sonic episode, Sonic 4 Episode 1 did that same thing. I think what's also emerged is Sonic is a powerhouse kids brand as well. Now, it has been for many years. I'm not saying that's new. But the interesting thing is that gives us options of how we take the brand to appeal to the core players and how we expand it to appeal to a younger audience. And that younger audience part is very key to us, and we need to make sure that Sonic, from a licensing point of view, is effectively reborn and is seen as a mass IP to within the children's audience. And that's a key thing that David and his team are going to be working on. But we think that's what's happened with our association with Wii and DS, is that Sonic has been hugely successful in that children's area, particularly with the Mario and Sonic series. So I think that's been an interesting thing, that we've evolved two very large audiences, and that gives us scope to develop different styles of game for that audience, and that's only going to continue. And again, coming back to all those different platforms allow us to branch out on those two broad areas.
Is there any final message that you would want to get out to any eager Sonic fans who are listening right now?
I would say, get the candles on the cake for June the 23rd. It's Sonic's anniversary.
Fantastic. Mike, David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you go. Duncan, you've learnt a lot then, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Quite a lot about console innovation.
I just want to move on to a little bit of feedback before we end the show. We had an email from a guy whose name I can't pronounce. Duncan, do it for me.
Vytautas Butkus. Maybe?
I don't know. That'll do.
Sorry.
And he emailed to say, I've started listening to your podcast recently, and I have some concerns that dogs are seriously underrepresented. Since probably all three of you like cats more, or would not dare admit otherwise in front of Nate, damn right, I think the best solution is to include a dog in your panel as a fourth member.
Well, I disagree with you, and I agree with you. I disagree with you that the three of us like cats more. I can't speak for Liv, but I am most definitely a dog fan, first and foremost. I'm allergic to cats.
Right, well, in response to this, I've decided we're going to have a bonus story about a dog, so here comes a dog story. A Brighton man has been fined £80 and threatened with legal action for failing to keep his skateboarding dog on a lead. Apparently, a landscape gardener, Mr. Fell, 51, said that the dog is always under control, he loves skateboarding, and he's not a criminal.
So there you go, dog story.
There you go, bonus dog story for you. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show. Duncan, tell people how they can get in touch.
You can get in touch with us on Twitter. You can get in touch with us at WiredUK. I'm at Duncan Gear. Nate is Nate Langson. And Liv, who isn't here right now, is Olivia_Solon. You can also get in touch with us on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com, hit /WiredUK, and then hit the like button, then talk to us.
And you can always send us an email about dogs, cats, or anything else, in fact, for that matter, podcast@wired.co.uk. As you can tell, we do read all your emails.
That's podcast, not podcat.
Yes, podcast. Very much so. And we will see you again in 1 week's time.
Goodbye.